I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Football can be violent, but current evidence suggests that concussions don't necessarily lead to long-term problems. And for youth, the social benefits of organized sports is very real. Today, two local pediatricians weigh the pluses and minuses of high school football to figure out if districts should be supporting contact sports in the first place. Also, whether you forgot to pick up the milk or you cheated on your partner, "I'm sorry" can be a very powerful phrase. We'll learn how both the offended and the offender can find peace after the damage has been done, intentionally or not. Later this week, State House Blend, Kansas. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Last week, the college football season came to a thrilling finish with Clemson's last-second win over Alabama. Watching those incredible athletes, it's easy to forget that just 1 to 5 years ago, pretty much all of them were playing high school football. There's an ongoing conversation, though, about whether contact football at that level is really such a good idea. In light of possible injury, some question if educators should really support such a violent, dangerous sport. Others, though, point to the benefits. Last week, KCUR's Brian Ellison sat down with two physicians, both from Kansas City, who come down on opposing sides of that debate. Here's their conversation.
Dr. John Lantos is Director of Pediatric Bioethics at Children's Mercy Hospital and Professor at UMKC of Pediatrics. Dr. Lantos, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also Dr. Gregory Canty. He's medical director at the Center for Sports Medicine at Children's Mercy, and he's also a professor at UMKC. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Canty.
Thanks very much for having me.
So the paper that that the two of you were two of the authors of is titled, "Should School Boards Discontinue Support for High School Football?" Let me ask the most obvious first question. Should they, Dr. Lantos?
I think school boards should have great concern about accumulating evidence that the head injuries and head trauma that occurs in high school football could be impairing kids' academic performance and, more importantly, cause long-term chronic brain damage. That evidence has been accumulating over the last 10 or 15 years. It certainly made headlines with regard to NFL players, the movie that came out last year with Will Smith dealt with some of those problems. And I think for school boards, we're living in an era of great uncertainty. We don't know how often injuries happen, how serious they are, or whether they can be prevented.
So if you had your druthers in a perfect world, you'd say maybe school boards shouldn't be supporting high school football.
I would recommend that they discontinue high school football.
But Dr. Canty, you think it's more complicated than that, right?
I think it's much more complicated than that. But I completely value those opinions of people that are questioning it, because I think it brings up an excellent conversation. As the medical director of a sports program, son of a coach, the son of a former school superintendent, this conversation takes place in a lot of circles for me, whether it's in patients' rooms or, you know, with discussion with people out in the community. And I really think that the evidence is quite premature when it comes to concussion. This is a big question about concussion. And I think until we have better, more sound evidence, this is challenging. And I think the thing we should really focus on is, how do we make all sports safer for our children? And how do we keep young children during? And when I talk about young children, oftentimes I'm picturing a 15-year-old, 180-pound, adolescent. So it varies when we talk about kids, as whether we're talking about a 12-year-old or a 17-year-old. But I think we should focus on keeping kids active and doing sports and activities that they enjoy. And clearly, there's a large population of people that enjoy the sport of football.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the risks and the benefits, and let's start with the risks. Let's talk about data rather than just what we think we know about concussions. It does seem like football is the most dangerous sport kids play. Is that a fair assessment, Dr. Lantos?
Football and hockey seem to have the highest rates of head injury. One important fact that's been coming out of the latest research on this is that the focus on concussions might drastically underestimate the amount of brain injury that's taking place. Because in football or in any collision sport, there are lots of high-impact head collisions that don't lead to a concussion, but there's accumulating evidence that they do cause chronic brain damage.
And Dr. Canty, I mean, do you argue with that data, or is it just a matter that a concussion is not as serious as people think?
I disagree with that statement. With a concussion, I believe is a serious matter, and I believe that when you take a look, we've known for years that football is a collision sport. The goal is to tackle another person and to bring that person to the ground. And so I welcome the discussion about the risk of head injuries in sport so that we can talk about how to make those sports safer. I believe it is a risk, but I believe it's also been shown to football, by being the most popular sport we play in America, and it's by far the most popular sport at the high school level. It's more than double the next popular sport, which is probably track and field. And so we're talking about over million boys play at the high school level alone.
But it'd be a pretty dramatic change to say can't do it anymore.
Correct. And it's not just about what you can't do it anymore. I think that what we're learning about concussion, it's easy to talk about facts when you talk about concussion. We like to talk about numbers. But what we really need to step back to is, so we still don't really even completely understand what a concussion is, what takes mm-hmm. place. It's hard to estimate it. We don't have a blood test. I don't have an MRI. I don't have a computer test. And none of those accurately diagnose a concussion. And so in some estimates, I think there's never been a safer time to play these sports because we are bringing light to it. We are being very proactive, trying to educate coaches, parents, families, school boards about the potential risk and the signs and symptoms of possible concussion and trying to get them removed. And so some would argue that this is the safest time in the history of sport when it comes to head injuries or other related symptoms.
Okay, so maybe it's worth making this distinction. We've been talking about high school football. I mean, kids are playing football even younger than high school. I assume when we're talking about 9 and 10-year-olds playing football, maybe would you take a different position, Dr. Canty?
I would continue to say it's unknown because it's much harder to assess a 9 as 10-year-old when you talk about symptoms related to concussion, and those do concern me a little bit. And that's mm-hmm. where I think we look at ways to make the sport safer. Well, what are ways we can do that? Some of the talk is advocating for more non-contact or non-collision leagues at the youth level. But again, that's not based on any evidence or data. That's based on what we're doing right here, just some of our opinions.
Yeah. Dr. Lantos, you're a specialist in bioethics, in pediatric ethics.
Correct.
And part of what I wonder about is the fact that these are youth we're talking about. We're not talking about NFL players who are getting a gazillion dollars to make this choice. You're talking about young people who we don't consider to have agency in terms of choices in a lot of other areas.
Sure.
Is that a factor in why you think this risk is so high?
Well, it's a huge factor for two reasons. One, as you said, kids may not make the best decisions for themselves, so we tend to be more protective of children than we are for adults. If an adult wants to take the risk of playing football, I would certainly not advocate preventing them from doing that, although I would want to make sure they had the information. The other bioethical consideration picks up on something Dr. Canty said, though. We don't know a lot about concussions, and we certainly don't know a lot about the subconcussive traumatic brain injuries. What we do know is that the NFL just settled a lawsuit for over $1 billion, so there seems to be some pretty strong evidence that over the course of a lifetime, these injuries to football players have pretty serious side effects. People develop dementia in their 30s and 40s. So living in an era of uncertainty, the question is, do you err on the side of protectiveness or do you err on the side of risk-taking? As a bioethicist thinking about children and the problems they may face, I would err on the side of protectiveness and say, until we understand more, let's not expose children to potential risks.
We're talking about the risks and some of the latest thinking on high school football and its possible dangers. We're doing that today on KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, sitting in for Steve Kraske. We're talking with Dr. John Lantos and Dr. Greg Canty, both from Children's Mercy Hospital and both professors at UMKC. We've talked about the risks. Let's talk about the benefits, too, though. And Dr. Canty, I see you want to respond to what you're hearing here.
Yes, Brad. Thanks for that. Touch on a few things that John mentioned, in that there have been a lot of large lawsuits when it comes to the NFL and the NCAA recently, but we don't know how that translates down to the youth athlete. A lot of the NFL literature is really talking about players that played in the 70s, 80s, 90s. They were grown men. They were not taking concussions seriously at all during that era. And we don't know exactly how that correlates to what does that mean to a 17-year-old playing a sport, I think is one thing. And I think we have to be cautious about making that leap. And the other thing that's important that we talk about the dementia, we talk about depression in some of these former athletes, and we take a look at all the headlines, because that definitely is what catches the media's attention these days. But when you take a look at some of the data that comes out, when you look at players 5 years out and further, there aren't these tremendously large statistical differences in dementia and depression in these athletes. And so I worry that we're reacting to headlines and not as much good data on what's happened to these former NFL players, because obviously when we see one of these players suffering from similar effects that we enjoyed cheering for and rooting for 10 and 15 years ago, it's devastating. But we still have to understand these are still real people. They have other life complications. They have other life health risk, and we can't always attribute, and that's one of the things I worry about, is that we attribute all mental health issues. Mm-hmm. We attribute all of these to concussion, and people sometimes aren't getting help for conditions that are actually manageable because they think it's all due to concussion, and I don't think that's always the case.
So, and part of your argument is not only that we don't know all the facts about the risk side, but also that there are some actual benefits. I mean, what do you see as a doctor, but also as one who's been involved in the sport? Correct. What do you see as the benefit of football?
Well, I think as a sports medicine physician, my biggest emphasis is on trying to encourage actually youth to participate in a sport. My personal feeling is that more people probably die from watching sports than playing sports, because the issue is in that we're not active enough. If you look at the World Health Organization, and that, you know, we talk about the fact that, you know, one of the biggest things, health risk, is physical inactivity, and we know that youth not participating in a sport, they're much less likely to reach and meet physical activity guidelines. And so I hear the comment, you know, often, well, why don't they? You know, I don't like football. It's a dangerous sport. It's a collision sport. Why don't they go out for cross country?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot of kids that don't want to run cross country. So it's not like if we take away football, that they're all going, everyone's going to convert and want to join the swim team, play tennis, or do cross country. I have a population that enjoys the sport. And,
mm-hmm.
and my personal feeling is, and based on the evidence and the way that I read it, is I want to give them every opportunity to enjoy a sport that they love. And I want to do everything I can to try to make that sport safer.
So, Dr. Lantos, you're smiling. I mean, does he have a point?
Certainly a point about the dangers of watching. I almost died watching the Bama-Clemson game, but that was mostly from anxiety.
Right, and that can be treated, right?
I hope so. With regard to the benefits, though, clearly participating in physical activity is beneficial, and all kids should participate in physical activity. But equally clearly, some very aerobic and potentially beneficial sorts of sport we have banned from high school. So high school kids don't participate in boxing, even though training to be a good boxer would be beneficial. Why? Mm-hmm. Because it causes so many head injuries that we've decided that that's not an appropriate thing for kids to participate in.
But what about
adults
this?
Still do.
Right.
And we don't ban that.
But what about this argument that look, the kids want to do it, and the kids who are turning out for football are just not going to go turn out for tennis.
I think there's no basis for that claim. I think if a high school did not offer football, I doubt that sports participation would be lower. I think people would play soccer and basketball and cross country and swimming and fencing and whatever other sports were offered. But that is another one of the uncertainties. If it turned out that high schools stopped offering football and all children stopped exercising, then I would say we should try to make football safer and continue to offer it.
Well, and I do want to talk about that, but I guess the other reality, as I think you both would agree, is that it's not likely that very many school districts are going to ban football. Part of that is because of the benefit to that is perceived to the communities as well. And some of it may be a financial motive, but it's not just finances. It's sort of the town spirit, the band, the cheerleaders, the Friday night lights of it all. Is it right to consider those benefits to more than just the individual players alongside the risks to them? Should that be a consideration for you as physicians?
I believe it's a risk. And I believe it's something we have to look at really as a culture, as how we basically approach sports. I mean, you look, sometimes some would say sports has a kind of a misplaced emphasis in our culture, but it's hard. You take a look around the country, we have high schools building millions and million-dollar stadiums to entertain these Friday night lights. And, you know, I'm big on all sports participation. I love to see it, but I want kids to have the same opportunity to play whatever sport they desire. Mm-hmm. And so it's not even always that I'm always just pro football. I'm anti-banning a sport, and I think that we should take a look, and we should really encourage and endorse all of our sporting activities for our youth and high school age athletes.
So how do you feel about high school boxing?
You know, I also had the privilege to serve on a couple of other national committees, and I think that it's an interesting question, and I get a lot of patients, and actually I see today, and I think in theory it's easy to say boxing was a bad sport. The goal was to hit someone in the head repetitively and to cause a concussion. At the same time, I'm not for sure that banning it has really done us a ton of benefit. I see just as many kids now, they've just transitioned to MMA. And so I think there is a particular
But the schools aren't sponsoring
correct.
MMA.
And I think that is that is a very interesting point. The schools aren't sponsoring MMA, and I'm not for sure that we'll ever go back to school-sponsored boxing. And I think it's a good analogy, but I also think that prohibiting the sport, in my opinion, probably doesn't result in the outcome we want, which is everyone transitioning to a more Gentile
sure.
nation and a Gentile sport with lots of aerobic activity. I just don't think that's going to happen.
Here's what I see as the likely flip side of the social and economic benefit to the community. I think decisions are going to happen in two arenas where they don't happen now. First, I think a lot of parents are going to start looking at the data that's coming out about head injuries and decide that they are not going to let their kids participate in sports. That's already started to happen in some places, and that will lead to schools being unable to field a team. The other thing that I see likely to happen is lawsuits against sure. schools that don't use best practices at the very least to prevent injuries, and therefore the economic benefit of having a team will be offset by the liability costs.
Well, let's talk about that then. I mean, let's talk about those best practices or the steps that individual districts and programs could take to make the sport safer. I mean, obviously, a lot has happened in the last 50 or maybe even the last 10 years to make the sport safer. Is that fair to say?
We think it's going to make the sport safer, just like the things we talk about, not having great data on what happens with concussion. Until we better define concussion, it's hard to know what effect the changes we're making today have. We won't have that data for 10 more years. But I agree with John completely in that. I think the things that I would like to emphasize on is how do we get school districts that are sponsoring the sport to follow best practices? Because I do think the risk is more the risk is more about litigation, I believe. I think as a culture, it's unlikely that we're ever going to ban many sports. But I do think the litigation risk is real. And I think the one thing that school boards can do, and we look at this across the country, and particularly across our metro and Missouri and Kansas region, large rural two states with a large rural population, is to are all of our schools following best practices? Do they have things such as certified athletic trainers attending events? Do they follow best practices on removing athletes from play if there's any concern about concussion?
Well, and I guess, can you answer that? Do they? I mean, do all the districts have those practices?
No. And I think that's one of the things I think we can start with is trying to mandate. I think it's the cost of playing. If you want to play a contact and collision sport, I believe you need to be able to have a certified athletic trainer at your school, at your events, and at your games.
So how do you, Dr. Lantos, I mean, maybe first let me ask, do you agree that these are the steps you take if you're a parent who's considering letting your child play football?
Certainly the things that Greg just said. The other big change that many schools have made, more at the college level than the high school level, is reducing the contact during practices.
Correct.
So most of the injuries, 80%, 90% of the collisions take place traditionally in practices. If the practices simulate game activities, many colleges have now eliminated tackling and other parts of football that are likely to lead to head collisions from their practices, which cuts down the number of collisions by 70 or 80%. That's a great thing. But even so, as Greg said, what we're involved in now is a vast, uncontrolled societal experiment. We know that the old way of doing football was dangerous. We've put in place changes that may make it safer, but they may not. And the question, I think, for parents and school boards is, Do we want to allow our children to participate in an uncontrolled experiment where one of the risks might be lifelong brain damage?
Dr. Canty?
Yeah, I think the other thing I'd like to comment on, we talk about school boards and should we sponsor this. The other thing that worries me a little bit, and I'm proud to serve on the Missouri State High School Activities Association board, where we look at these issues, is I worry about if we completely, when we talk about taking sports out of schools, what we can do is we can drive education. We can, oftentimes teachers and coaches in the school are invested in the community. And I worry often we don't have that same control over youth organizations. They live and die by much looser rules, much less regulation. Mm-hmm. And currently there's talk about trying to improve some of that. But if we drive all of these into a private youth organizations, their national governing boards and local governing boards have far less power and control to make changes and improve safe practices than our folks involved at the high school levels.
You two are in pretty strong disagreement about this here, but you work together. Are you actually friends? Do you actually see eye to eye on most things when it comes to medicine?
Oh, no, we can't stand each other. And,
they're having to seat us on opposite side of the rooms here today.
To bring it back sort of full circle, I guess I just, in a word, if there is any risk, really, to serious life-affecting injury to kids, should it be allowed to go on? I guess that's the final question, Dr. Lantos.
So here's where Greg and I completely agree. We both want to do what's best for kids. Exercise is good. Physical activity is good. Sports is good. Making it as safe as possible is the goal, and we disagree, I think, on how best to do that.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being here this morning. Dr. John Lantos is Director of Pediatric Bioethics at Children's Mercy Hospital and a professor of pediatrics at UMKC School of Medicine. Greg Canty is Medical Director for the Center for Sports Medicine at Children's Mercy and Assistant Professor at UMKC School of Medicine. Thank you both for being here very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much for having us.
That conversation was recorded last Wednesday. It's time for a break. When we come back, best-selling author Harriet Lerner talks about the apology. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we discussed changing perceptions of gender identity and transition with psychologist Wes Crenshaw. You can listen to that conversation at kcur.org/up to date. Then, do moderates still exist in American politics? Tomorrow, we'll look at the role of centrists in a partisan government. Well, Harriet Lerner has been offering sage advice on relationships and family dynamics for years. She's done that through talks all over the country and via 12 books, including the New York Times mega bestseller, The Dance of Anger. Her latest book deals with a seemingly simple concept, the apology. The book, Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. Harry continues her private psychotherapy practice in Lawrence, and it's always good to have her back here in the studio. And Harriet, welcome.
Oh, it's great to be back.
Why is this idea of apologizing even the subject of a book? Because you must think society has a big problem when it comes to the rendering of heartfelt apologies.
This is true. We're all connected. We all screw up. We all unwittingly hurt other people just as we're hurt by them. So the need to give and receive apologies is with us until our very last breath. And the reason that it's so important is if it's a good apology, it's deeply healing. If the apology is absent or it's a bad apology, It really compromises a relationship, and it can even end it.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example of an apology that is compromising in some way.
Well, there's such an imaginative variety of ways that we give bad, sleazy, blame-reversing apologies. The top two, one is with the word "but." We say, "I'm sorry, but."
I was going to ask you.
You know, I'm sorry that I yelled at you, but you provoked me. Or, I'm really sorry that I forgot your birthday, but I was just overwhelmed with work. It doesn't matter if what you say after the but is true. Mm-hmm. The but makes the apology false. So, rule number one, get your but out of your apology.
In other words, you want it to be genuinely heartfelt, or don't waste your words, if I'm hearing you right.
Exactly, exactly, because that word will undo the sincerity of any apologies, just like the word if. I'm really sorry if I hurt you. I'm sorry. Which brings me to the next way, the second biggest way, that we muck up an apology, which is we apologize for the other person's reactions or feelings rather than for our own specific behavior.
For example,
it is not an apology to say, I'm sorry that you were so upset when I corrected your stories at the party. It wasn't my intention to hurt you. That is a total non-apology. There's no accountability there. The real apology would be, I'm sorry that I corrected your stories at the party. I was wrong. You've told me that you don't like that, and I won't do it again.
Do it again. Yeah.
Exactly.
There you go. Yeah. What do we know from surveys, Harriet, of or whatnot about how often people feel slighted these days because a loved one hasn't offered an apology for the latest slight or another? How common of a frustration is this in our society?
I don't know about surveys, but I certainly know from my own investigation and life experience that, you know, we're really justice-seeking creatures. And when we don't get an apology, it just can feel terrible. And even sometimes when the other person isn't even at fault, like I was at the doctor's office and I waited an hour in the waiting room, and then I waited 45 minutes on the cold examining table. And the doctor comes in and says nothing, you know, doesn't even say, I'm sorry that you've been waiting for two hours.
That gets me in a red hot flash. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's not that I think that the doctor is to blame. I really don't believe that the doctor is out there texting her friends or playing video games.
Right.
But nonetheless, it puts a little crack in the foundation of the relationship, and it doesn't feel good. So obviously when there's a big hurt or a big betrayal from someone who really matters, it's excruciating.
You know, I'm guessing that one reason why people don't apologize more often is because typically they think the person they've wronged has also wronged them a bunch of times. And people say, well, you know, I'm not apologizing because the other person hasn't apologized. And I'm probably talking about close relationships here, marriages or serious relationships. Am I right?
That's Steve and I, or is it Steve and me,
yeah,
on our bad day, for example.
Your husband you're talking about.
My husband, yes, my husband. I write about him so much. I think that everyone knows him, but you're a Steve too.
Whether he wants to be written about or not, probably, yeah.
Well, I actually do run it by family members and friends. I am very good at apologizing in my marriage for my share of the problem, exactly as I calculate it, of course. And I expect Steve to apologize for his part of the problem, exactly as I calculate it, of course. And we don't always do the same math. And that can lead to exactly what you're talking about, like two people feel like the done-in person. Again, we're hardwired for defensiveness and blame. So I think he should apologize first because he's more percent to blame. Or maybe I think he, quote, started it, and he might have a different perspective. So, you know, it really takes a lot of integrity and maturity and good intentions to really step up to the plate and accept responsibility for our part of the problem without a hint of evasion or excuse-making or blaming or bringing up the other person's crime sheet or insisting they do it first.
Harriet Lerner will be presenting Why Won't You Apologize tonight at 7. It's a Rainy Day Books event at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For more information, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3300. 3126. Harriet, do you think a lot of people have to learn how to apologize?
Yes. And
it's a lost art.
You know, the problem is that a lot of people as adults are allergic to apologizing because as they were growing up, such a big deal was made of apologies and do it right and don't look at your feet and that wasn't sincere. Go to your room. And I have a very important piece of advice for parents here. It's very simple and it's so hard to do. If you want to teach your child to apologize, I have a one-sentence technique. When you ask them to apologize, which you may have to, and they do, just say, thank you for the apology. I really appreciate it. Don't put any add-ons.
Yes.
The add-ons are, well, you know, maybe next time I won't have to ask you for it. Or say that like you really mean it, you know, and have you really thought about how you hurt your little brother, excluding him from the game? And, you know, I've interviewed the kids, and they want to put their fingers in their ears. So if you don't want your child to grow up being allergic to apologizing, simply say, thank you for the apology. And yes, there may be more to talk about. Save it for a different conversation.
Harriet Lerner's new book, Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. You know, you asked some probing questions in this book, and I wanted to get to some of them that intrigued me here. One of them was, why is it so difficult for humans to offer clear expressions of responsibility and remorse for our hurtful actions? Why is all this so difficult to begin with?
Well,
for people who seek justice, as you already explained.
You know, we are hardwired for defensiveness. And it's very easy for us to apologize if it's a very simple thing. If you spill red wine on your friend's carpet, it's actually you're automatically going to say, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. Can I pay the cleaning bill? When it's a deep hurt, and especially if the hurt party is confronting us, we are wired to listen defensively, meaning we will listen for the inaccuracies, the injustices, the errors, so that we can correct them. And it's extremely difficult to put the defensiveness on a shelf and try to listen only for the essence of what the hurt party is saying, to listen only for what we can agree with, even if it's only 7%, and to apologize for that piece first. It is so difficult. It takes some, you have to have the intention where you, and the goodwill, where you say to yourself, you know, that other person says, we have to talk, those dreaded words. And try entering the conversation only to listen and ask questions and stay curious about the hurt party's experience. And try to get what you can agree with because, and this is so important, no apology will have meaning if we haven't listened carefully to the hurt party's anger and pain. And there's no greater gift than that kind of listening. There's nothing more difficult. And to be honest, Steve, people have very little motivation to enhance their listening skills.
I'm wondering, another big question you ask, Harriet, what drives the non-apologizer? In other words, why won't some people apologize? What is it?
There are many reasons. And for some people, it's just situational. They won't apologize because they're in a relationship where they feel that they're more criticized than they are respected. And it's very difficult then to apologize. Some people are entrenched non-apologizers. And that's something I've been very interested in studying. And an entrenched non-apologizer, and we all have one or two or seven in our lives, is someone that no matter how well you voice your feelings and how beautifully and gracefully you try to reach this person, they will never get it. They will never care about your feelings. They'll never orient toward reality or toward the facts. They won't get it. And what that has to do with is that in order to apologize, a person has to have a big platform of self-worth to stand on. Mm-hmm. And from that vantage mm-hmm. point, they can look at their mistake and they don't get overwhelmed with shame. They see it as part of being human, part of a much larger picture of who they are as a person. The non-apologizer stands on a small, rickety platform of self-worth.
That's interesting.
They can't get it because to get the harm they've done threatens to flip them into an identity of worthlessness or shame, and nobody can tolerate that.
Harriet Lerner is my guest. We're talking about her new book on apologizing. You make an unexpected point, I guess I should say, about forgiveness in this book. Unlike other scholars, you say forgiveness isn't the only path to a life free from bitterness in connection with all this. That might surprise some people. What's your problem with forgiveness?
Well, I take it even further. I have two chapters on forgiveness. They were the most difficult to write in the whole book, and one of them is called You Need to Forgive and Other Lies That Hurt You, because there are so many myths about forgiveness that are presented as scientific facts, and they're simply not true. And one myth is that there can be no peace or healing without forgiveness, that forgiveness is the only path to a life that's not mired down in bitterness and hate. That is not true. Another myth is that forgiveness is an all or nothing thing. You know, people talk about forgiveness as if, you know, it's like being pregnant. Either you forgive or you don't, mm-hmm. or you embrace the offender or exile him. And the truth is that you can forgive the other person 95% or 2% or anything in between.
Yeah. Harriet Lerner's new book, Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. Again, you can see and hear her this evening at 7 at Unity Temple on the Country Club Plaza. It's an event sponsored by Rainy Day Books and Fairway. More information, 913-384-3126. Harriet, thanks so much.
Thank you. And I want to mention that this is a free event.
Free event.
It's totally free. You do not have to buy a book and just come on out.
That's even better. Harriet, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This week's State House Blend Kansas was recorded live in Topeka. Host Sam Zeff explains why.
This is KCUR 89.3. I'm Sam Zeff with a special edition of State House Blend Kansas. We're recording this in front of a live audience at the Kansas Health Institute across the street from the State House, just after Governor Sam Brownback delivered his State of the State address. And I want to mention this is before his budget director, Sean Sullivan, delivers the details of his budget. With 51 new faces in the legislature, we wanted to move off just those regular talking points that you often get after such a speech. So we invited two freshman lawmakers, a Republican and a Democrat, to get their thoughts on what their voters want. So now let's meet them. Introduce yourselves, please.
I'm Ed Berger, a senator of the 34th District, which is Reno and part of Kingman County.
My name is Monica Murnian. I'm a representative from the 3rd District, which is Pittsburgh.
And we have a lot to get to, but first, we're going to hear the open.
This is State House Blend. I'm Sam Zeff. We're using coffee and donuts to help us better understand the historic legislative session underway in Topeka. The issues and the people in the Kansas legislature. Here we go.
And joining Monica, Ed, and me is my KCUR colleague, Jim McLean, also managing editor of the Kansas News Service. I want to get right to a clip of Governor Brownback where he essentially said things are pretty rosy in the state of Kansas right now.
Our state has record population, record new businesses, record grain production, and record income. My fellow Kansans, it's for these reasons and more that I can report to you that the state of our state is indeed strong.
Ed Berger, what do you think about that?
Well, you argue that certainly the revenues being strong. Then you talk a little later on about the difficulty in the economy as far as the oil and gas industry as well as agriculture. So even though those sectors might be really keys and pillars to the economy in Kansas, I would question whether or not the revenue coming from them is as strong as he suggested.
Monica, your thought, is it as rosy as Governor Brownback suggested?
The teacher in me wants fact-finding on all of those statements, and while I'm sure there is data to back up all of those indicators, the question is, what do they all look like together? What are they, when you mix them all together and make Kansas, what does it look like?
Ed, I want to bounce that back to you and ask, are you hearing that from your constituents around Reno County?
That was the message I got time and again as I walked our district. Fix the budget. They're very uncomfortable with the pass-through tax. They also saw a need for perhaps more solvency in the state, running the state like a business instead of like the federal government.
Jim?
So, Senator Berger, you mentioned the pass-through tax. Again, I think we ought to expand on that a little bit. There's already been a bill introduced in the session to deal with that, and that's part of the controversial 2012 tax cuts, but it essentially exempted businesses, pass-through income from businesses. About 300,000 business owners and farmers benefited from that. What's going to happen with that bill, and will the legislature go further than that in an effort to fix the fiscal problems?
I really can't predict what the legislature will do, but when you look at the pass-through, that's probably about $220 million. So that's not going to solve our budget problem. We probably need a larger tax package. We need a larger look at the tax code for the state of Kansas as we move forward.
And I want to move on to school funding formula, school finance. The governor talked about starting from scratch, writing an entire new school funding formula, one that is outcome-based. I want to hear a clip from him right now.
The time has come to create a school finance system driven by outcomes that provide more opportunities to our students. We need predictability and sustainability for both educators and taxpayers. We need to measure success not by dollars spent, but by the achievement of our students.
We have two educators here. Monica, I'm going to start with you. You are a teacher. What do you think about this notion of an outcome-based formula, one that might reward school districts for an increased graduation rate, better ACT scores, or penalize them should they not reach those levels? Where are you on that?
Outcomes to me are when a kid in Galena has the same opportunities as a kid in Blue Valley. There was another statement that the governor made talking about the zip code. Zip codes mean a lot to me because I'm in zip codes where kids don't have a lot. And schools don't have the ability to generate funds because of the property taxes.
Ed, you were a former community college president, so you've seen a lot of Kansas kids. What do you think about the previous formula before we went to block grants?
I think that formula was something that worked. It took into consideration the variables of zip code. It took into consideration the variables of who is in your school, and it also took into consideration looking at the schools themselves and their production.
Jim, I was a little surprised that healthcare got so much time in the governor's state of the state, something that you follow closely. You're an expert. What did you hear from the governor tonight on healthcare that stuck out to you?
Yeah, he left really, there was no doubt about how he feels about the issue of Medicaid expansion.
For states who took the expansion path, the reckoning could be severe. Given these facts, it'd be foolish to endorse Obamacare expansion of Medicaid now, akin to airlifting onto the Titanic.
We've had this debate in front of us for 3 years, but haven't had the debate.
Right. This is probably the part of the speech where I made the most notes while we were visiting, because I have to say, I think we're past bashing Obamacare or Affordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it. And it's just about access. His response about the Titanic Quite honestly, so many of our people would love to see a boat. A boat would be good. Any boat.
Some sort of canoe, some sort of...
Anything is good. Moving the direction towards a dentist who can pull the tooth out of their head. It's just as simple as that.
And Senator Berger, you were counted on by the expansion forces as now a supporter. How do you feel about it now, given all the circumstances?
Yeah, you can look at this issue from two sides. The number one side has to be the consumer and the 150,000 people who are being denied access to CanCare. And the other half of it certainly is that hospital, especially a small rural hospital, that is really struggling to survive. And this is their services they've got to provide, but they won't be compensated. Same thing cascades down to your nursing homes as well.
I want to ask both of you about something that was a big surprise for me, and that is the $15,000 bachelor degree. We didn't get a lot of details on that, but essentially what the governor is saying is that somebody in Kansas is going to be able to come up with a program where you can get a four-year bachelor degree for $15,000. And Ed, you are the expert. I'm glad you're here tonight.
I'm not an expert, but I want to hear what you know if this is possible. Be very difficult, you know, to hit that target, just looking at a community college education. To me, it's a puzzle. I'm not sure. You can throw a number out, $15,000. I'm not sure how you're going to arrive at that without additional state support for those universities to offset tuition increases.
Monica, real quick.
I think that, we have a budget problem, and we have tax policy problem, and throwing in something like this, well, as a mother of 320-somethings, I'm all for it, does seem to be a little off of the focus where we need to be right now.
A good place to leave it. My Kansas News Service colleague, Jim McLean, your expertise, always welcome on this podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Sam.
Representative Monica Murnan, a Democrat from Pittsburgh, and Senator Ed Berger, a Republican from Hutchinson, this is where we turn the podcast over to you. And we're going to vote on our walk-off music. You both have...
This is so much pressure.
I've heard this...
I've been thinking about this since I got the email. I've brought in consultation. I missed a committee meeting because of this. I don't like this.
You nominate your walk-off song.
Fleetwood Mac, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. Oh. Because everything has to revolve around classic rock.
Ed, your song.
The heat is on. Definitely, the heat is on.
Wow. That's all right, I have declared myself a superdelegate, and we're going with the heat is on. Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp with help tonight from Mike Russo and Amy Jeffries. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on kcur.org/StatehouseBlendKansas. There it is right there. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Sam Zeff. My co-host Brian Ellison takes care of the Michigas over there in Missouri. He is at PTS Brian. I'm Sam Zeff. I'll see you around the radio.
You can find full episodes of the Statehouse Blend Kansas podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, be sure to subscribe to Statehouse Blend Missouri as well. Tomorrow on the show, are moderates a bunch of wimps, or do they have a role to play in such a partisan political climate? We'll find out. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Todd Okoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.